From Washington, D.C., across the nation and around the world, stand by for an overview of the hottest topics and people being discussed on air, online, at the coffee shop and across the backyard fence, powered by the research of Talkers Magazine, The National Conversation. It's time for the Michael Harrison Wrap. Here's Michael Harrison.
Thank you, Victoria Jones. Monday, May 24th through Friday, May 28th, 2021. It was a week of continuing conversation about COVID-19, the vaccines, and continuing vaccine hesitancy by many Americans, as well as the pandemic's long-term effects and renewed concern over its origins. Did it begin in a Wuhan biolab? And if so, what were the circumstances? That's the big story of the week. But there's more. Americans have been mouthing off about the proposed January 6th Commission and the GOP's reluctance to pursue an investigation of the events that led up to the storming of the Capitol by happy-go-lucky tourists. Suspense grows over the criminal investigation of the Trump Organization in both New York State and New York City. Will damning evidence be uncovered, or is it just a politically motivated witch hunt? The president, or rather the former president, did a number of radio talk shows this week still talking about how the election was stolen from him. Some in the media and politics are calling it the big lie. Others, however, think it is actually the big truth. What do you think? And oh yes, we mustn't forget, although I'm afraid we will. There was another mass shooting this week as 9 innocent people, along with a crazed gunman, lost their lives in San Jose, California. And that's just for starters. Americans have been talking about climate change, immigration reform, U.S.-China relations, social media bias, and race relations as we marked the first anniversary of the death of George Floyd on the hard pavement in front of a convenience store in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Stand by, as we're about to be joined by media thought leaders left, right, and center for a bold hour in which your tolerance for hearing different but legitimate points of view will be tested. Try not to get angry. The world's a messy place. We're going to be joined by opinionated folks from all over the country with microphones, smartphones, and digital recording devices, sharing their observations and the feelings of their target constituents with whom they do their daily dance of affirmation in a deafeningly noisy world in which we try ever so hard to avoid the modern-day syndrome of seeking victory at the expense of truth. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Wrap, an examination of the past week's hottest political and social topics discussed in the American talk media. Information's gathered from a variety of sources, including data tracked by the broadcasting trade publication Talkers Magazine, of which I'm editor and publisher. Okay, here we go. Joining us now is Kevin Casey, executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Kevin, give us a rundown of the 10 most talked about stories on talk shows in America this past week.
Thank you, Michael. At number 10, immigration reform tied with social media bias. The crisis at the southern border continues to be a humanitarian nightmare and serious security threat. However, the Department of Homeland Security describes the U.S.-Mexico border as more secure than ever. Regardless, prominent Republicans, backed up by reporters on the ground, continue to view the U.S.-Mexican border as out of control and insist that the United States should consider broader reforms to its immigration system only after the border has been secured. For that to happen, we need timely, reliable, and publicly trusted indicators of immigration control.
On the social media front, the big platforms such as Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube remain the targets of public and legal scrutiny based on claims that they engage in politically based censorship. In other words, that they're biased. There's a big First Amendment battle brewing in Florida as a federal lawsuit is seeking to strike down a Governor Ron DeSantis-inspired law that penalizes social media companies for barring the speech of political candidates. Our resident expert on cyberspace and the law, Steve Wiseman, will be joining us to analyze the situation.
At number 9, the economy tied with the infrastructure. Senate Republicans made a $928 billion counteroffer to President Joe Biden's sweeping infrastructure proposal on Thursday morning.
On today's program, we'll hear from Talkers Radio commentator Claire Carter, who says, if we're going to invest money on the infrastructure, before we worry about roads and bridges, we should make improvements in protecting the electric grid, which is extremely vulnerable to attack from hackers, rogue nations, and natural disasters.
At number 8, climate change, the greenhouse effect on global warming remains a major political and social issue in the national conversation.
Big Oil was dealt a notable defeat this past Wednesday when shareholders of ExxonMobil elected at least 2 board candidates nominated by activist investors intent on steering the company toward cleaner energy and away from oil and gas.
At number 7 this week, the San Jose mass shooting and gun control. Wednesday's massacre at a rail yard in the California city is being described as the deadliest mass shooting in the history of the San Francisco Bay Area. The violence claimed the lives of 10 people, including the gunman, whom law enforcement officials described as a highly disgruntled employee of the rail yard.
And each time we're faced with the regular occurrence of yet another mass shooting, we grow increasingly numb to the horrific implications of this unending syndrome amidst calls for implementing stricter gun control laws.
At number 6, U.S.-China relations and U.S. foreign affairs. China is reportedly still furious after the United States Navy sent a warship through waters in the disputed South China Sea near the Paracel Islands in a mission it said was to assert navigational rights and freedoms. China has described that action as illegal. The warship, the USS Curtis Wilbur, has since moved on.
Of course, the attention currently being paid to the escalation of conversation about the murky origins of what was once referred to as the Wuhan coronavirus has not done much to improve relations between the two competing superpowers. More on that story later on.
At number 5, claims of 2020 election fraud tied with voter legislation. Former President Donald Trump has been making the rounds as a guest on talk shows across the country, repeating his claims that the 2020 presidential election was rigged and stolen from him because of widespread voter fraud.
His detractors in both politics and the media refer to this practice as the big lie, and which in turn is fueling a number of GOP-controlled state houses to follow Georgia's lead in enacting legislation to clamp down on registration and voting procedures loosened and expanded during the pandemic that was raging during the 2020 presidential election.
At number 4, Trump Organization criminal investigation. The vice tightens on the former president and his associates, including family members, in the Trump Organization as the Attorney General of New York State and the New York Southern District DA pursue criminal charges in their ongoing investigation.
District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. has impaneled a grand jury of Manhattan residents to weigh evidence in the criminal probe investigating the Trump Organization's alleged financial fraud.
At number 3, a four-way tie between race relations, police reform, anti-Semitism, and Asian hate crimes. This week marked the first anniversary of the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police.
An event that proved to be the tipping point that ignited what has become a historic reckoning between the races in America. Of course, a concurrent rise in incidents of anti-Semitism and Asian hate crimes on the streets of America hasn't helped matters either.
At number 2, the January 6th Commission. Republican senators have delayed passage of a bill to investigate the January 6th breach of the U.S. Capitol.
Meantime, the relative handful of moderate Senate Republicans such as Susan Collins and Mitt Romney says that this only makes it appear that the GOP is engaged in a cover-up of information that would link former President Trump's actions leading up to and on the disturbing events of January 6.
At number 1 this week, COVID-19 origins, vaccines, and long-term symptoms. President Biden has revived concerns that China is indeed responsible for COVID-19, either purposefully or through neglect and cover-ups, through his call for an investigation of what really happened at the Wuhan laboratory in 2019 and the crucial months that followed the outbreak of the virus.
Debate over vaccine hesitancy on the part of many Americans is viewed as an impediment to putting the disease in the rearview mirror, and concern over the lingering and long-term effects of COVID-19 continues to grow. Thank you, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. Okay, let's begin our trip around the nation by visiting with one of Washington, D.C.'s leading talk radio personalities. He hosts The Morning Show on one of the most respected news talk stations in America, WMAL, Larry O'Connor. Well, Larry, there's certainly a lot of talk about Donald Trump. One would think he's still president, or certainly that he's running for president. Trump is the gift that keeps on giving in terms of content for talk shows. But some of your thoughts, and how are you handling on the air a couple of things having to do with Trump? Two things. One, the fact that he has been continuing to go on talk shows around the country claiming that the election was a fraud and, stoking the flames of that concern. And two, the fact that the grip, the vice around him seems to be tightening in terms of his problems with the New York Attorney General and DA. Where do you want to start?
Well, I'll take the latter first. I mean, when the latest announcements came out, at WMAL, we try to draw on some pretty great guests and pretty strong experts in the field. When stories like that, legal stories come in, I've got the former U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Joe DeGeneva, at my disposal, who is a local personality and a regular on our station as a legal analyst, and also Andrew McCarthy, who used to work as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. So, you know, I call on them and say, give me context, shed light on this for our listeners. What does this mean? How relevant it is? How important is it? You know, we'll watch how this legal thing plays out. There's two aspects to it, Michael. The legal aspect, Andrew McCarthy came on and said, you know, honestly, this isn't that big of a story from his perspective. It's the state attorney general who really wants to be governor, who is trying to get headlines. She won that office by telling the people of New York that she'll investigate then-President Trump. So she's just sort of trying to show them that she's still on that case, I suppose. He saw it as more political as an actual legal story. But we'll see. You know, listen, as it plays out, we'll cover it if it's relevant to our listeners, as we do any story. The politics of it, from our listeners' perspective, is it appears to be the state of New York using the law to try to attack politically a political opponent of the dominant party in the state. That's how they see it until there's more evidence that suggests that there's criminal wrongdoing. So we'll see how it plays out. With regard to his views on the election, I mean, honestly, he hasn't come on my program. He could come on Dan Bongino's show, which is on our WMAL debut this week. You know, I would, to me, I think that there are still legitimate questions that deserve to be addressed at the state level, as we saw in Georgia, with regard to who gets to set the rules for an election to determine the Electoral College decisions for president. That's an important fundamental decision that needs to be made. I think that it's fair to say, and I would hope my Democrat friends would also agree with me, that last year's election was extraordinary in every way because of the pandemic, and there were many norms that were broken under the guise of the COVID-19 pandemic and regulation. That was disconcerting to many people. Would I go so far as to say what the president says, that it was, the entire election was a fraud and that was stolen from him? Well, no, clearly, because Joe Biden is our president and he's in office. I wish that the legal challenges had taken place before Election Day to all of these changes in our electoral laws at various states rather than after, because afterwards it's very difficult to do so.
What are your thoughts about Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's getting a tremendous amount of attention? The media seems to enjoy the sensationalism that comes with talking about her.
You know, it's funny, Michael. I mean, and again, maybe I'm so intent on ensuring that our show follows the news of the day that is relevant to our community and to our listeners. You know, you started by saying you can't, you know, Donald Trump is still such a dominant story in the news. I haven't mentioned Donald Trump much this week at all on the news. I know that it's a big deal in certain journalistic endeavors, but not necessarily to my listeners. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, my goodness, ditto. I mean, she is in the first half of her first year as the freshman congresswoman. If I were in Georgia, you know, it wouldn't matter, I guess, because I'd be speaking to those who she actually represents. And I would say, do you feel well represented by Marjorie Taylor Greene? You know, but honestly, for the greater Washington area and Maryland and Virginia and Washington, D.C., she's really not relevant. I haven't really discussed it. She represents the Republican Party as much as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez represented the Democratic Party in the first half of her freshman year, which I honestly, not so much.
Meantime, talking about local issues, is there a lot of chatter in D.C. about the potential for it becoming a state? Is that an issue that's on the minds of D.C. residents?
Well, it is, certainly, and we discuss it in various ways. I'll be honest with you. And here's what's interesting about doing, you know, morning drive in Washington, D.C. Morning drive, by definition, is accommodating those people who are driving to work, which means they're not D.C. residents, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm talking to people from West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia who are heading into the district. Most of those listeners, honestly, they want to adhere to our constitutional norms that our federal capital should not be contained within a state. If there's any concern about taxation without representation for D.C. residents, that I hear from, and this also, I do have listeners in D.C., of course, and you know, they don't like the fact that they aren't represented but pay full taxes. They would prefer to do away with the taxes part of it.
Well,
that's right. And, you know, I don't like taxation without representation, so let's address these taxes. I don't want to pay federal taxes, you see. The one elegant solution that I hear from many of my listeners, and I tend to agree with it, is that if this is a great concern for the hundreds of thousands of people in the District of Columbia, then why not retrocession and have those people who reside in that area go back to the state of Maryland and keep the federal corridor free from that influence?
That's Larry O'Connor, host of the morning show on WMAL in Washington, D.C. Coming up next, a trip halfway up the Atlantic coast to a place known as the Queen City, Charlotte, North Carolina, and a visit with morning host Bo Thompson of radio station WBT. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. One of the great bands of the golden age of album rock, Gun Hill Road, has been around for more than 50 years. The members of Gun Hill Road are Steve Goldrich, Paul Reich, Glenn Leopold, Brian Coonan, and yours truly, Michael Harrison. I wrote the lyrics to a song on our new album, What Year Is This? It's titled, I Know You're Real. It's about the relationship between human beings and our friends in the animal kingdom.
I know you're real.
Please take a moment to write down the following web address to see the music video of this inspirational song that contains some wonderful animal images that'll rock your heart and soothe your soul. Here's the address. Write it down. IKnowYouAreReal.com. That's IKnowYouAreReal.com. If you love animals, you'll feel real good after seeing this video. IKnowYouAreReal.com. Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap. For many years, there's been a close relationship between politics and news talk radio. In some cases, politicians become talk show hosts. In other cases, talk show hosts become politicians. In Charlotte, North Carolina, we have a case of an individual going in both directions. When former governor and longtime political staple Pat McCrory lost re-election, he became morning co-host at the state's biggest talk station, WBT, where he enjoyed wild success. But the call of politics is too much for him to resist, so he's taking off his headphones and preparing to take a run for the state's U.S. Senate seat coming up for election. We caught up with his extremely popular co-host, Bo Thompson, who'll be carrying on.
Well, I have hosted mornings on WBT from 5 to 10 a.m. for almost a decade, Michael, but in recent years, the last 3.5 approximately, Governor Pat McCrory, formerly of North Carolina here, came and began to host the last 2 hours I'm on the air with me, and so I spent 3 years doing a show with him, and our show did really well as we've done in that period in a long time. But I saw in his eyes that he wasn't quite finished with politics, and this is a guy who was governor for 4 years in North Carolina, and then here in Charlotte, where I am, he was mayor for 7 terms, so 14 years. So you could see in his eyes when we started doing the radio thing that he enjoyed the radio, but you could still tell that politics was not quite out of his system, and eventually I knew he would run again, and he decided to make that decision to put his hat in the ring for U.S. Senate here for the GOP back about a month ago. And so we had a top-rated show that was doing really well, but he decided he was going to leave, and so, you know, it's an unusual situation here in radio, but I am in transition mode, as you say now, and evolving the show to its next incarnation, I guess.
You know, they say, I'm often asked, they say that being on talk radio is almost like being in politics, that it is a pulpit, and it is a platform. Having watched this play out, would you say that the former governor's political stock has grown as a result of being on big radio stations such as WBT all this time? Is it true that being on talk radio is a link to being in politics?
I think so. And by our format of news talk, we're talking about politics much of the time. I mean, WBT is in some ways a full service station, to use an old school term, but in modern times, much more, unless there's breaking news, there's a hurricane or things other than politics that would send people to a news station. We talk politics when all things are equal for the most part. And so it's a world that Governor McCrory was used to, but he came into my world as the lifelong radio guy, and the two of us, I think he might have, I'm estimating here, but I think it's pretty darn close. He probably has 85 to 90% name recognition in this state. And so you talk about a guy who has celebrity political power, and then you have a radio station like WBT, which is on the doorstep of 100 years. You combine those two heritage items together, and it made for a very successful radio show.
You have a reputation for being an excellent journalist, an excellent radio news reporter and commentator. McCrory, obviously, you know, was more the opinionated type, and news talk radio is extremely opinionated. That's one of the appeals that it has. As a matter of fact, a case could be made that it's the rise of news talk radio that has changed journalism. Everybody's getting in on the act, that newspapers, cable television, they're all opinion first and, you know, objective reporting second. How do you balance that with your background as a, you know, with you and the governor? You were sort of the voice of moderate journalistic reason, and he would be the one with the opinions. Where do you stand now, and how are you going to deal with that?
Well, I think the experience with Governor McCrory made me a better broadcaster in the end, because you're right. I was here long before Governor McCrory came into the picture. I'd been hosting mornings for, you know, 6-7 years by the time he got here, and I, as you say, had sort of formulated my brand pretty well, which is down the middle. I'm giving you the news, but I'm not going into opinion mode unless it's something innocuous and not you know, partisan lines. And when he came along, we had that discussion because I knew he wanted to go those places. That's part of his bread and butter. And I said, if this is going to work, you're going to have to understand when you get to certain places, I don't want to go with you. Then we have signals or eye contact or what have you that will let you know that I'll lead you to this place, but then you're going to have to go without me for parts of it. And, you know, it's like any time you work in a broadcast environment, you have to get to know someone. And I'm going to tell you, Michael, it was a roller coaster ride for about a year. And then he had to learn how to trust me, and I had to learn how he operated. And once he realized that I'm the radio guy, I'm the guy that's going to set you up to go where you want to, but we're going to make a radio show out of it. We're going to tease things, and we're going to use broadcasting tools that hopefully will keep the listener around. Once he realized that's what I'm good at, and I can set him up for the opinion parts, we worked really well together, and we really clicked about 2.5 to 3 years in, and the ratings and the revenue showed it. But it was a process. It was a dance, and I do think that he respected where I didn't want to go, and I respected where I knew he wanted to go, and we trusted each other to get the other there.
So where are you going to go now, that you're not going to have him? What type of pivot are you going to do in terms of your own take on the issues and your own steering of the ship?
Well, like I said, it's been a five-hour show for me for the most part of my on-air career at WBT. And before Pat McCrory, it was 4 or 5 hours of really the same type of radio, commuter radio. You know, I would, if there was something really hot that day, I would talk about it in the 5 o'clock hour, and probably just like a music hit on the radio, I'd come back to it in the 7 o'clock hour and keep it going. McCrory's show started at 8 o'clock, so it was from 8 to 10. And when we got to that part of the show, there was a decided change in tone. I told listeners the day after he left, Michael, that I wanted to keep the DNA of the show from the standpoint that it would be a little bit looser after 8 o'clock. It'd be more conversational, and I would get into things that maybe I didn't earlier. The other big thing that I decided that I wanted to do was bring on a guest co-host every day from 9 to 10. So I've been doing that for about 5 weeks, and as I said, Governor McCrory is quite the celebrity in North Carolina, so I knew whoever I had to follow him with had to be somebody that would get people's attention. Also knowing that Governor McCrory is a bit of a unicorn. I mean, we've had the discussion in meetings around here. You're not going to go out and find another Pat McCrory. You just don't get a four-year governor, a seven-term mayor. He's not out there. That's why I think we had lightning in a bottle with the show. But I've managed to bring in some co-hosts that I think have been compelling, like Bill O'Reilly joined me for an hour. I had a great show a few weeks ago with George Norrie, who precedes me on Coast to Coast before our morning show here, and he was just a blast, and it was great to get him in a different setting. He had to extend his day a little bit, but I was very honored, and it was really a great thing in my career, honestly, a bucket list moment that he would stay and do an hour with me with all the stations he has and commitments. And then Mick Mulvaney, who was White House Chief of Staff and a former South Carolina congressman, joined me for an hour, and he was 5 feet away from President Trump for the better part of a year. So I've been able to bring in people like that, mixed in with others, and done some compelling radio, and I think by the time this is all over, we'll probably land on a person or several people that will be in static days. But right now, that transition of having different people each day is what I'm doing. And I tell you what, I've had a lot of fun over the last month and a half. It definitely keeps me on my toes.
That's WBT Charlotte morning host Bo Thompson. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. COVID-19 still dominates the national conversation. This past week, the talk show discussion focused heavily on the investigation launched by President Biden to get to the bottom of the coronavirus's suspected murky beginnings in Wuhan, China. We're joined now by our medical correspondent, Dr. Dahlia Wax of the Genesis Communications Network. Dr. Wax, the COVID story just keeps on rolling on, and it's taken a turn in terms of the national conversation this past week. There's been tremendous talk about something that actually was talked about at the very beginning of this year and a half, and that is suspicion that it started in Wuhan in a laboratory, and now it's becoming somewhere between investigative and conspiracy theory. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. So, yes, this is something that I believe you covered, I covered, so many of us have talked about. And the reason why I had brought it up years ago or early on was back in 2003, the Singapore Ministry of Health released a report investigating the first SARS outbreak and concluded that patient zero most likely acquired the infection in a laboratory setting as a result of accidental contamination. And they were discussing the original SARS virus coming out of China. Then in 2004, a year or so later, a couple people died in China from exposure to COVID, or SARS, I should say, SARS at the time, due to lab contamination or lab accident. So when the 2019 outbreak happened, we were thinking, all right, I guess this is number three. And then nobody talked about it. Nobody brought it up until finally the State Department in the previous administration said, look, we think this came from China. Nobody listened to it. Nobody covered it. And then now Biden has launched an investigation with hopefully a report within 90 days. But unfortunately, much of the evidence could be already scrapped at this point.
Yeah, I was going to say that, can an investigation, come up with anything at this point? Because this has been, if in fact it was caused nefariously by Chinese and people in that lab. It already was being murky and muddied up and, hidden back when it first started. Remember, there was talk about that.
Yes.
Matter of fact, I think the doctor that reported it, was killed or something. I don't remember exactly what happened, but remember there was that whole scandal about the
A doctor went online to tell other doctors, look guys, this is what I'm seeing in the ER. This doesn't look right. It's not fitting the typical strep pneumonia or the other illnesses, so let's talk about it. What are you guys, because doctors will talk on message boards all the time, then unfortunately he comes down with COVID and dies. And there's been a lot of speculation on what happened there.
All right, now let's talk about something else that we're hearing about, and that is long-term symptoms. That, at first everybody was saying, all right, you get it, and if you get, and unless you're really, subject to the worst, if you're overweight or you're old or any, have pre-existing conditions, comorbidities was the word that we were all introduced to. We're all being introduced to a lot of new words, comorbidities. Now we're hearing that if you have it and you get better, maybe you're not really getting better. And they talk about COVID fog and symptoms. What's your take on this?
Exactly. So this long COVID or this long haul COVID can manifest in a variety of different symptoms: brain fog, fatigue, memory loss, cough, fertility issues. We've seen testosterone drop, sexual dysfunction. So there's been many issues reported months after: lack of smell, lack of taste, which to me implies that the virus just doesn't die off like we see with flu. It could actually maybe either stay in the body and persist, or it could cause damage that persists. So it's not the typical virus. And so today there was a report that looks like we have better natural immunity than we once thought, and natural immunity to COVID could last years. The problem is this is not a virus I would want people to get naturally exposed to. So even though I would like to be immune to it, I want to be able to smell. I don't want to think that it's sitting in my brain affecting my olfactory nerve. So this starts to mean we're dealing with a beast that we don't naturally deal with. And then, you know, as you transitioned from the Wuhan lab leak theory, was this something that was tinkered with? Mm. You know, was it a naturally occurring virus that might have been tinkered with, which is why it doesn't follow all the typical logic that the average cold virus does? So if we don't know what we're dealing with and we don't know what was done to it, we're going to have a tough time deciding how we approach the virus long term.
Now, this is something that really stands out. It is that different from most viruses, in as much as that lends to the theory that it was tinkered with, you know, otherwise known as man-made. And all right, well, you clarified that. Well, you clarified something that can't be too clarified because we don't know. But that does make a lot of sense. Where do you think it's going to go? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I mean, if they want to investigate, what they're going to have to do is if nothing was scrubbed or cleaned in terms of hospital records, find out when there were these atypical pneumonias and then see where those people worked. And they're going to have to go back to the summer of 2019, because that's when I predicted this all started, because of the numbers of amounts that came in December. And then if they want to prevent the next pandemic, they're going to have to look at laboratory practices. I don't think a lot of countries are going to be excited about transparency, because I think the average country does have bioweapons. I think the average country does study these. And this was a wake-up call to laboratories across the world that you could have a lab accident. Do I think China really released it on purpose? No. But do I think people are studying these viruses to come up with counterweapons and vaccines? I do. It's just, it's a shame, because about a year and a half ago, I said China needs to pony up and give us information so we can make our vaccine. But everybody wants to play dumb, and they wanted to, you know, not accuse anybody. And here we were having to make vaccines from scratch.
That's our medical correspondent, Dr. Dahlia Wax of the Genesis Communications Network. Coming up next, a trip to the wild world of the internet and social media bias. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap.
Some mistakes you just can't fix, like your retirement. You only get one chance, and with Grace Advisors, we'll help you make the most out of your one chance at a great retirement. At Grace Advisors, we make sure your retirement income is not at risk with the up and down ride of the stock market roller coaster. Instead, we build a foundation for your retirement, where when the market's up, you're up. When the market's down, you lose nothing, and we structure your plan in a way that you will save more on taxes, giving you an even greater return on your nest egg. So speak with the Grace Advisor, a Christian company, helping families protect their future every day. Call 888-585-1615. That's 888-585-1615. Call 888-585-1615 and speak to a Grace Advisor today. Or visit graceadvisors.com/radio.
Continuing now with the Michael Harrison Wrap as we discuss the hottest topics of the past week in the national conversation. Hardly a day goes by in the national conversation when Facebook or Twitter or social media aren't in the news, accused of bias or embroiled in controversy. We're joined now by our resident expert on cyberspace and the law, Bentley University in Boston law professor, and the founder of the website Scamicide.com, Steve Wiseman. Now we have a story breaking out of Florida that seems to be interpreted in different ways constitutionally. Can you fill us in?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, you get a lot of criticism of social media, and you get it from both the left and the right, which almost makes you think they must be doing something right, or either that or they're doing everything wrong.
Right.
But the bottom line is Florida became the first step to actually do something about this. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law recently the Stop Social Media Censorship Act. And what this does, or proposes to do, is to limit the ability of social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter and TikTok and others to restrict user content. And a lot of this comes particularly from Republican anger over the banning of former President Trump from Facebook, and also what they see as an anti-conservative bias. This will provoke some discussion, but that's all it will do, because it's quite patently unconstitutional. The First Amendment prohibits companies like Facebook and others who are private from being forced to publish or not publish someone's speech. It is really up to them. Then you get down to the thing that has been really a target of both Republicans and Democrats in Congress, and it's this Section 230. Section 230 was of the Communications Decency Act, and it was a federal law that holds online platforms like Facebook and others immune from liability as long as they are policing it on their own. So what happens is it was first put into effect when you'd have a site like YouTube or a site like Facebook that other people would post on. And so holding them responsible for any kind of libel or something that was inappropriate was deemed to be too limiting on what at that time was the new internet. So that Section 230 allows these various social media companies to post things without liability. Now, liberals tend to say that this lets the online platforms get away with leaving too much harmful material up, and the conservatives argue that they take too much stuff down and that it censors conservatives. So nobody likes this Section 230, but it's a federal law. And the federal law, this 230, preempts Florida. Florida can't do the kind of thing they want, as well as the First Amendment. But it's going to prompt some real discussion.
Isn't Section 230 a loophole around the First Amendment in terms of Facebook having to adhere to some type of responsibility because they have that grandfathered immunity?
Well, the interesting thing is, of course, and this is something that always bears repeating, the First Amendment limits the ability of governments to limit free speech. Companies can do whatever they want. An employee can be fired for a social media post or something that he or she says, regardless of what the content is. A company doesn't have to. A company can limit free speech. You know, here on talk radio, we don't allow. We can limit what people say on talk radio. So the First Amendment only limits the government. So Section 230 protects from liability, but it really doesn't the social media platforms. But it doesn't give them any kind of new rights that they didn't already have. But there's a lot of reasonable people who say that 230 should be reexamined and that we should have some kind of standards. So, for instance, one of the things Florida wants to have due process rights for users about giving them detailed information why content might be taken down. That seems like it could be something reasonable to rein in some of the total power that social media does have at this time.
That's law professor Steve Wiseman of Bentley University in Boston and the founder of Scamicide.com. You're plugged into the Michael Harrison Wrap. This week marked the one-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis and the eruption of emotions that have been described as a racial reckoning in America. We caught up with WOLB Baltimore morning host Larry Young, whose long-running morning show focuses on the African-American community. Larry, your thoughts and the feelings of your callers upon the one-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd.
I posed the question, George Floyd's murder 1 year later. And I said to my folk, and they responded, that on May the 20th, 2020, we witnessed a public lynching of George Floyd. A black man in Minneapolis was held down and killed. We all watched over and over again in virtual America. He could have been my father, my brother, my cousin, uncle, or son. In the original teachings, we are all related and all family. Not only did George Floyd die that day, so did the progression of the dream set forth by the Civil Rights Movement, a dream of equality that motivated many generations to come forth. I'm concerned because, as I heard from my many, many callers, George Floyd was a loving father, a devoted brother, a partner, a friend. He deserved to be remembered as those who love him remember him, as someone whose smile lit up the room. He was caring. He believed in people. His life mattered. And my callers were saying that America failed him, and so many others before and after him. But in the wake of his death, we've seen a nation awaken to the reality that black Americans live every day. They were telling me that we have seen some people across this country and across the world demonstrate that changing the reality we live in is not an impossible task. I was told that it's going to be our collective calling. Great Americans before us have demonstrated what this moment so urgently demands. Not just the right words, not just our voices, but action to be taken. And they're calling for the passage of the George Floyd Policing Act, concerned about it being stalled in the Senate. And one of course, we're fortunate here in Maryland that our congressional delegation is there where it needs to be, in both in the House and the Senate. And they were crying out, what more can be done? Can the president pull it off? Will the two parties decide that this is the best interest and it shouldn't be politics, it should be what's right and proper for the nation?
That's Larry Young of WOLB in Baltimore. Okay, we have time for one more. Last week's show was titled Vulnerability, and frankly, so could this week's be called that as well. If there's anything we've learned from this past year and a half of the pandemic, it's just how vulnerable we are as individuals, not to mention as a society. Joining us now is Talkers Radio personality and founder of GoodForYouNetwork.com, Claire Carter. Every time we talk about the grid and we talk about hacking and we've been talking about the pipeline and we there are so many things that are in the news these days, Claire, I think about you because I want to set the record straight right here for everybody. You, with your radio broadcasts and podcasts and website, have been on this topic longer than almost anybody out there in the media. You even produced and sang a rap song about it. So I just want to give you that credit. But now here we are in 2021 and vulnerability is the name of the game. What are your thoughts about the situation with the grid?
I think a lot of Americans are basically in the dark about just how vulnerable the grid is. And I know I was. Back in 2014, I read an article in the Wall Street Journal. It was an opinion piece, and it awakened me to how vulnerable the grid was. And then the next year, in 2015, it was Senator Ron Johnson who was holding hearings for the Homeland Security Committee, and he had on James Woolsey, the former CIA director. What caught my attention was Johnson said, quote, The purpose of this hearing is basically to pull our heads out of the sand. This is a threat. It is real, and we need to acknowledge it. And then here's James Woolsey, the former CIA director under Bill Clinton, saying, we're talking about total devastation. We're not just talking about a regular catastrophe. So all of a sudden, he's saying, if the grid goes down for any extended period of time, there millions of people could die from a lack of food, water, communication, transportation, a breakdown of society, no jobs to go to, no banking. And this is serious people who are talking about this. So I started getting interested in what are the different ways that our grid could go down. I assumed our civilian grid was hardened. It had the equivalent of power surge protectors that we have in our house. But it's not just cybersecurity that we've been hearing about so much with the Colonial Pipeline. That was just a few days. Imagine if more of the grid went out. In addition to the cybersecurity attacks, there's something called electromagnetic pulse. An electromagnetic pulse attack, Michael, would happen, let's say a rogue nation has a nuclear tip missile, and they explode at high above our atmosphere. It generates enough electromagnetic pulse to literally the energy could bring down our vulnerable grid. Mm-hmm. And in addition to electromagnetic pulse, there are solar storms. What are we reading about this week in the news? Solar activity that might disturb the grid. But back in 1859, there was a solar storm that hit planet Earth. It was referred to as the Carrington event. Now look, the horse and buggies were okay, but the telegraph machines were set on fire. There was no electric grid at that time. And they say that in 2012, we were really lucky, and a solar storm hit Earth's orbit. Fortunately, we weren't there at the time. Mm. So with all of that, you know, I'm thinking right now, infrastructure bill. And I read about, $100 billion for broadband and expanding. There's nothing wrong with expanding broadband. But without an intact grid, you don't have broadband. Without a grid that's fully functioning, you don't have the electricity for electric cars. So to me, job one that I would say to Congress and the President is shield the grid now. Where's the plan? You know, where is the plan and the price tag?
Yeah, what is shield? What does it mean? Grid? What do you mean by shield the grid? Is there something that can actually be done whereby there's less likelihood of the grid going down, either by an act of nature, as you're saying, you know, a sun flare, or a rogue nation blowing up a nuclear device above our, you know, heads, which would bring the grid down, or hacking? What do we do? How do we protect ourselves from this?
You've got to have the equivalent of a power surge protectors on the grid. If the grid goes down, we don't have enough spare transformers to get it back up. And again, we're talking worst case scenario. But people like Dr. Peter Pry, who I interviewed for Good For You Radio on talkers.com, he's been involved in commissions, on congressional commissions on the grid. These date back to 2001, 2005. These things have been talked about for so long. And that was why I was thinking in terms of the infrastructure bill. If we don't do it now, Michael, then when? Mm. So the experts can tell you what needs to be done exactly, because there needs to be a partnership between the government and all these private companies that own these, you know, electrical substations and the like. But there certainly have been the people who are involved in the congressional commissions would know the know-how, people like a Dr. Peter Pry, like a James Woolsey, because it was the two of them that wrote that opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal in 2014 that alerted me to the seriousness of it. I mean, these weren't people crying out for no reason at all. There is real information, there's real data, and I go to the experts to find out the ways in which you actually protect the grid and put the equivalent of a power surge protector on it.
That's Claire Carter, founder of GoodForYouNetwork.com. You can listen to Claire on TalkersLive.com. Check her out. And that concludes this latest installment of our show. This has been the Michael Harrison Wrap, looking back at the past week of Monday, May 24th through Friday, May 28th, 2021. Looking ahead, I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about next week, including the ever-lurking unknown factor, that unanticipated surprise story that can take the national conversation spinning off in a totally unexpected direction. We sure do live in interesting times. I can be reached via email at michael@talkers.com. My podcast, The Michael Harrison Interview, can be heard at mhinterview.com. And if you want to stay in touch with the inner workings of the talk media industry, please visit talkers.com. And that does it for this week's installment of The Michael Harrison Wrap, an overview of the national conversation. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Wrap is a production of Good Phone Communications in conjunction with Talkers Magazine and Talk Media Network. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved.